purposes and for public interest purposes. And I think you have the opportunities in there to begin to find out what systems are cost-effective in a cable system.
Well, will you at least stand up, because it's hard to hear when you sit
in. I think we've started off talking on hardware systems, and I think we're now getting around to what really is the problem. That's in terms of how you're going to use the software system that provides the actual information. We have presently two decent hardware systems, broadcast TV and phones, and we may end up with some good cable and the broadcast one. And I think what we've got to get into is how you can best use the hardware systems that exist to implement the functions that you really need to properly run the city.
Well, the difficulty of maximum utilization of existing facilities points up the difficulty you're going to have in selling somebody a new one. Obviously, we can get more out of what we've got than we're now getting. But part of that problem, I think, relates to what we were saying earlier, is that we have put those systems there, assuming that because they're a good idea, everybody's going to use them to the maximum. And we have not done the propagandizing, if you will, to talk about what the maximum capabilities of the existing systems are and insisted that we use them to the maximum. Now, maybe that sounds contradictory. Maybe if you start doing that, it's going to make it even harder to sell the need for something new. I don't know. But I think we have basically failed all along the way to maximize the technology which is already available, which is going to make it even harder to get the new stuff in and make it useful. And if I could comment just 1 second on the earlier question about that, is it going to cost as much for the person indirectly if the information's in the community as opposed to downtown? There is so much information in a city hall that would be useful to citizens if they knew it was there and if it was available to them without having to go fuss and fight with people all the way downtown to get it. It may be optional information, not necessary for survival, but optional. And I think if it were made more readily available in the communities through the little city halls or whatever you want to call them, that better use would be made of it by citizens, and ultimately the cost factors would tend to lean in favor of putting them out there because people would use them more.
Unless there be some misinterpretation of what Gus said, in the analysis we got back from these mayors, there was predominantly a general accommodation for the things we suggested. At the same time, there was this warning that they had no money and you couldn't get it. You couldn't expect them to be buying it. The other thing that I'd like to comment on is that Gus spoke about the problem of getting politicians to understand, and yet I think he has at least a particularly favorable condition in that his mayor, Gibson, is an engineer, and so he must be able to understand these a little bit better than some others. I don't know how about the rest of the politicians that surround him.
Well, he's just now learning how to be a politician, Bill.
Are not threatened by this sort of thing, but are actually rewarded for
Just a brief comment. To some extent, I think this relates to the comment Bill made earlier that the technologists have devised a way to keep people from having to come into the cities, and we said drop that one because we want people to come into the cities. The concern you raise is a very legitimate one, and I think that any kind of technology which is developed needs to be examined in the social context as well as the technical context. And if, given the problems of the cities, you're going to develop something that will improve the delivery of health services while putting 5,000 people out of work, forget it. Because the health of that city is going to be worse off with 5,000 more unemployed people than it is going to be with treating the measles more efficiently. I'm not demeaning telemedicine at this point, but I think the concern you raise is very valid. Anything you do is going to have to be examined in the total social ramifications of it before it's brought into the community.
Well, within our proposals and so forth, though, was one area which discussed the general problem of the use of both cable and computer-aided instruction for this matter of continuing education, which I think does attack one of these problems of reorienting people as the demands change. It's not the full problem, but this is one of the problems. This whole matter, of course, of what the society ought to, as the IEEE should be doing in this, has been a matter of great concern. And in another committee I was in yesterday, I was assured that there are going to be major pronouncements within the next 6 months of some of the things which the IEEE should be getting into, but I don't think that is really what we are talking about today, except to the extent that continuing education might be helped by some of these uses of telecommunication.
Serving society, it was to be left to the marketplace, tempered by a fine hand of government in the form of perhaps FCC rulings and sort of a natural process depending on current mechanisms we have serving society today. Now, the question is, relating to serving the needs of the city, what faith do you have in those mechanisms, the marketplace, supply and demand, and the traditional government regulatory body, getting to you the channels that you need and the systems that you need.
I have very little faith. My lack of faith is reinforced by the present plight of the cities. Had that system been functional, the fine hand of government, for example, isn't very fine. And had it been functional, well, the cities would not be in the state they're in today. So I guess my simple answer is I haven't got much faith in that. And the whole question of the market supply and demand is distorted in the cities in the crisis state in which they now find themselves.
Dick Everett has some comments on this, too.
Well, I would observe, of course, that you don't have a free market situation to start with in the city because there's subsidy of certain functions of the body of a city right now. In other words, let's go to a national one that's very obvious to all of you. Where were the cost trade-offs done on the need for a national highway system? Is anyone aware of careful cost analyses of cost trade-offs? I see one head. Finally, I see someone shaking up and down. I've never heard of the cost trade-off analyses of that. In other words, what I'm saying is that how are you going to have a private enterprise type of system come up against another system in which you're dealing with the same problem of body functions and expect that the private enterprise system can truly survive? At the moment, the body function of circulatory system is being government subsidized. In other words, in the case of the city, your streets, highways, all of these things are being government subsidized. Now you're saying that apparently this morning the idea was that wouldn't it be nice if at least in telecommunications we could let that develop on a incentive basis, the free enterprise basis, and so forth. And I certainly would be highly in favor of it, but unfortunately the competition for it, in this case the trade-offs for it, are not in the same mode. And I don't see how we can hope for some of the basic nerve functions of the body to become established on strictly a profit and loss basis. As indicated here today, many of these functions are not by themselves capable of supporting the total power of a cable type of network. And but when taken in combination, they do support it. Did you want to come back and try that other question, Mr. Henningberg, or not?
No, I'm not running away from the question.
All right. Okay.
Okay, thanks very much.
Back to the point I made on planners before. Again, there has to be some conceptual view of the city and some trade-offs being done in terms of the various functions of the city. And to say that one of those basic functions of the city, the nerve system of the city, should all be on a P&L basis while the other functions of the city are going to be tax-supported, I think that's an unreal world.
Let me comment on a couple things in this area. When you're talking urban operations, I think you're talking, one is the ability to pay for things, and secondly, what you're paying for, and whether or not there's prospects for hope in the area of the ability to pay. There are two things. One, there is some form of revenue sharing coming out. One can see whether it's this year or sometime in the foreseeable futures, people have recognized that local governments and their sources of taxation are insufficient to pay for the bills they have to pay for. Secondly, one can see in several of the court decisions that one cannot require the financing of school systems based on a very narrowly based tax arrangement, and that one needs a broader arrangement. There's still a long ways to go, but obviously the courts are taking a look at how one finances school systems, which again will affect the ability of cities to cope with their problems and changing their ability to pay for things. Let's go back to something else. No matter what, the city pays for a lot right now. It buys a lot of services. And one of the points that's being made on the market system is whether or not you can bring in a service that maybe not comes in with, or it's not the question of does it provide a little bit gold plate to a service or so, but is it cost effective compared to an alternative means of paying, providing that service? And on that basis, that's a legitimate thing and a legitimate way of looking at the market mechanism for the urban service that's being provided.
Art Goldsmith, the Department of Transportation, but he's also been one of our sponsors.
Now, I just wanted to add, while we're talking about the free market, free enterprise system, nevertheless, in the context of the urban environment, this ain't necessarily so, and we certainly have to give injections to this system, and I can refer to several very specific items that under the $10 billion Urban Mass Transportation Act, which provides something like $500 million for R&D, but the balance of it is for capital grants to communities to enhance their transportation system. And included within that, in many cases, has been telecommunications, because we do realize that this is an important factor in the future enhancement of urban living. And then recently, the administration has advocated better utilization of the highway funds for the urban mass transportation in addition to just pouring concrete. And I can assure you that we're going to promote the utilization of providing telecommunications equipage and better enhancement of both the safety and efficiency of transportation through the use of telecommunications. So while they may talk about that in some of those other areas, in actuality, it ain't necessarily so. We are supporting it.
Well, will you stand up, because people can't hear you, really.
I wasn't trying to elicit the responses that is the work of marrying technology to the needs of the urban community really proper. The concern that I had was whether or not the channeling of resources in the most efficient way is going to be handled by the test of the marketplace, or by, let's say, planning from the top, by the traditional government bureaucratic functions. Let's put it that way.
Gentleman over here has been trying to get his attention. I don't think it's either or. I think you've got to do both.
There's some sort of mix, though.
Yeah. No.
Thank you. I don't think I could be heard without having a microphone in hand. I'm Bern Erb. I'm with AT&T Company and have been in the telecommunications planning business for a number of years. And one of the things that, from the discussion today, that seems to me we haven't really talked about, and that Mr. Heiningberg alluded to, was that we're really not addressing his requirements. And perhaps the conference with the mayors that the committee had that went back and said, are these things that are useful to you? And he said, no, I don't need these things. I haven't got any money to buy this kind of thing. Maybe we need to go back and examine and help the communities to examine what the actual requirements are. What is it that they're trying to accomplish? We can develop all kinds of technological systems to do almost anything that we want to do. But are we meeting the requirements of the cities? Are we meeting the requirements of the communities? Now, the fellows from the medical branch will probably say, well, yes, we've got all these people that have poor health supplies and poor health supports, and we need to do something to get more medical aid to people. Is that what the people want? Is that really what their needs are? Somebody else alluded to the fact that they needed jobs and they needed to be able to earn a living. Well, there are certainly a lot of things, a lot of jobs that could be done in a community. Are we helping people to get to those jobs and do them? Now, addressing the subject, you might say, of our session here this afternoon, can telecommunications help to solve these problems? Well, in the first place, telecommunications help people to communicate, and that's really their only purpose, is to transfer information from one place to another, from people to people, generally. Now, you might go through some intermediate stages and transfer it from computer to computer or sensor to computer or something of this sort, But the idea, essentially, even if it's in the medical field, it's got to be transferred from people to people. And I think this is the thing that we fail to look at. We fail to go back to our requirements to find out what we're really trying to accomplish. And therefore, our efforts are being distended across a broad area that are really not focusing on the objectives of the community.
I think there's a misunderstanding from one casual remark that Gus made, and I'm sorry he isn't here. But by and large, the comments from the mayors were that this is good. But I'm going to ask Mr. Rosensky to tell the length we went to ask the cities, not merely in terms of having a mayor's conference at the end, but with representatives from a variety of cities. Now, sample cities is essentially what we had to do. This business of sending out a questionnaire and waiting until you get back, you generally don't get the right answers. But Rosie, do you want to tell them the extent to which we went to make sure we were getting input from the city?
Right at the beginning of this activity, we were told and we decided that we don't want to approach this situation by being technicians who would go to the cities with our answers to their problems ready-made. So the first thing we did was to go to the cities and ask them what their problems were. And we, being a small group, we couldn't hit too many cities, but we did, through the International City Management Association and the National League of Cities, pick out sample cities of different sizes throughout the country. And we worked in great detail with these cities to find out what their problems were and how they thought we could help them with these problems. Then we set up sub-panels in each of the city functions, like transportation, health care, and so on. And we took the problems of these functions to our technical people to provide answers to the cities. And then we kept a continual cross-fertilization going with cities and our people to make sure that what we were trying to do for them is the things that they wanted done.
And you mentioned some of the cities that we worked with, Atlanta, Nashville, et cetera.
We worked with New York City in certain problem areas. We worked with Washington, D.C., with Nashville, with Atlanta, Sunnyvale, California. And then through the International City Management Association and the National League of Cities, we took a much larger group of cities to try our ideas on before we put them in final form. So there was a continual back and forth flow between technology and the cities on the answers to their problems.
Gentlemen in the room. I don't understand you whatever, because I don't know what you're accusing us of doing, or who we are, or who you are. No, not one of us. Oh, well, over here, yeah, he was the our liaison with the federal government. No, we're a committee of the National Academy of Engineering with representatives from a wide variety of telecommunication organizations. And then we went to someone like Henningberg, who's with the Urban Coalition in Newark. However, that's an independent, not a city operation, as I understand it. But the rest of us were about four or five professors and about 14 or so industrial people, mostly at the vice presidential level, who in turn tapped on people back of them. So I think you have a misunderstanding of who, what this program was. It's a report to the Department of Housing and Urban Development by the Committee on Telecommunications of the National Academy of Engineering.
Robert Mills from the Boyd Company. I'm sure we least 20 of the reports of your commission, which have a lot of cities in our own area, and that is part of the job of education and public officials and city officials, and the problems that you're alluding to. It's been since last summer, I guess, that your report has been out with some very excellent pilot program suggestions. And I'm kind of wondering at this stage what, since well alluded to here, that the cities themselves are not going to provide this, be able to provide the funding for this program, even though some of us are talking with them and exploring certain opportunities. I'm just wondering what impact the report has currently had on some of the decision makers in OTP and other places. And I know Dr. Gold with the slide up for the ideal way of implementing these things, DOD picking up some of these concepts and financing them themselves as they see needed. But I was wondering if on a gross scale then the demonstration program that you've suggested have an impact on some of the decision makers in the federal government.
First, I might make add one additional part to the organization of our program. I've identified what sort of people were on the committee. Concurrently, there was set up a committee of government representatives from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, chaired by the Housing and Urban Development, from the Department of Transportation with Art Goldsmith, from the FCC, from the Department of Commerce, and about six or eight different departments. But in terms of his question, Alan, can you respond to that question as to what the impact of the report is? Remember that things move not too rapidly in government. Also, they move in different directions during election years and as compared with other years, but I wish that you'd give some comment. I don't know whether Art has anything to add to it or not.
I think the first comment to make is that this report was given to us in July 1971. The federal budgeting process runs close to 2 years. Very shortly, we'll be starting our pencil scratching for fiscal year 1974 funds. We are worrying our fiscal 1973.
We're talking
to the Congress right now about our request for this coming year. So it's quite an advance undertaking for significant amounts of funds. And some of these projects require large amounts of funds and decision making at very high levels in the government, both from a standpoint of the impact of such projects upon the lifestyle of the United States, and secondly, upon the fact that it does require coordination among a number of federal agencies. And to try and get multi-agency projects undertaken is a time-consuming process. With that comment, let me just suggest that there were some special projects that I believe are being undertaken. For example, I believe there was a telecommunications cable TV technology handbook that was proposed and is being funded by the National Science Foundation. Another proposal was to carry on further on not just how telecommunications can improve existing urban characteristics, but there was the recommendation by Peter Goldmark to explore the impact that telecommunications technology might have upon small town development and providing an alternative to industrial location. The concept is several fold. One, the possibility of organizations being split up, business operations being split up, and small organizations, subsets of the organization, being moved and being physically separated, and communications making up for the physical separation. The same being true for healthcare and so on. And this exploration is being funded in the northeastern part of Connecticut as an actual case. So there's another example of activities underway. Art Goldsmith has mentioned some activities, I believe, that the Department of Transportation is undertaking, so that the concept had been to get a number of pilot projects, some of which can be undertaken basically by single federal departments in furthering their missions and would contribute to an overall impact. Meanwhile, there's some work going on internally in the federal government on trying to undertake a multi-agency program. And I guess that's enough.
This reference to the cities of the future, that was chapter 4 in our project. Well, I think the answer to that is that we did, we only made analyses of what the next step would cost in certain cases and recommended certain projects, which in general included that type of approach as the next step. I might mention that we had a vice president of AT&T was a member of our committee also.
I don't think we did the type of study you're talking about, but we identified the elements of cost that would be involved and that would have to be evaluated and studied to determine whether such a program might be viable. Now, the area I was active in was the potential role for communications in regards to transportation systems. And our committee, working with Dr. Goldsmith, quite early came to conclusions that the biggest contribution we could make would be relative to public transportation systems. You can get into all sorts of private car warning systems and so forth, but these get to be rather sophisticated, and on top of that, they leave you with still the excessive investment in a city and concrete and everything else to accommodate the individualistic desires in a crowded atmosphere, which of course are two inconsistencies. And so we turned our attention to public transportation, and we had a member of our task force who was from Chicago and very active in the Chicago transit system and was aware of the problems of a public transit system. And he provided us, and through his contacts with other inputs, to help guide us in regards to what really makes sense from a cost standpoint without actually sharpening the pencil down to the last decimal point. And when we made recommendations, we made them with the idea that such things would be cost viable if one took a look at the trade-offs that one would obtain in the long run. For instance, if you could, by using communications, increase the attractiveness, in this case we're talking about bus communications, to be able to tell someone at the street corner with a device on the street corner as to when the next bus will be there, or which bus he should take to go to a certain location, things like that, whether the next one that will be there that will not be excessively loaded. In other words, you've been keeping track of the load on buses through systems. If you can provide that sort of thing and increase your bus travel by 25%, then you can definitely pay for this sort of system, not just in terms of the bus system itself, but more in terms of the decrease in requirements for additional private facilities, private car type facilities. And so we tried to identify some of these trade-offs that would have to be analyzed if you are going to pursue this possibility. But at this first thrust was to identify more of the possibilities, and we tried to stay out of areas, though, that were obviously absurd from a cost standpoint. We tried to think in terms that were at least worth evaluating further, but we did not get to the sharp pencil point. You're quite right.
Perhaps I should repeat something that I did say early in my talk, but people come and go. To a large extent, we were talking about a sample or two from a particular report, Communications Technology for Urban Improvement of the Committee on Telecommunications, and we have already distributed some 4,500 or so, and we have 6,000 copies, and we about exhausted our copies, but it is being reprinted by the and is available through the National Technical Information Service of the U.S. Department of Commerce at Springfield, Virginia, and is available at a cost of $3 per printed copy, or 95 cents for a microfiche copy. We also have on a sheet of paper up here this information and a list of four reports that have come out from our committee in the last 4 years, although not at the necessarily the rate of one per year, because they're on different subjects, including the application of social and economic values to spectrum management. And these are available, and if you want more information, we have about 20 copies of this information up here on the basis most of you won't want them, but they're available after the meeting.
Do you have the number of that report there?
Yeah, it's a that particular report is PB 200-317. In the back, way against the door.
I did not read this report, and I don't know whether in there you make any analysis of the LEAA effort. This is the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. Here, from what I know, and this is not an awful lot, the federal government has undertaken cities to the extent of the first national information retrieval of all fingerprints. So we have here prototype of Georgia City medical retrieval on a full district chart, where if a patient walks in, the health care center need not then wonder whether
Well, the answer is no, we did not cover that. The street. You can't run a particular form of this.
told them that they had a complaint. Their children could not pass in school. The reason being that they had to go home for lunch and often couldn't get back. The reason for that is that there was a freight track, and during the lunch hour, the freight train would, you know, then come on, and they couldn't get back to school on time. This is all that was also. So would he, the city architect, planner, propose a solution? Yes, he would. His answer, or update, was have fewer children. Well, I had to, you know, walk that man home. But I think the point is that if we are talking about consultation with the cities, we've got to look a little bit deeper than a consultation with the mayor or with the professional city planners to get down to the people, I think, for whom Mr. Hedberg tried to speak.
Well, we had Mr. Hedberg particularly, and several others, as has been mentioned. We did not give attention to the first item. We did have a section on crime prevention, including a discussion of 24-hour television surveillance. We even had a test made with the police, working with the police in one district in New York City. I think it was out in Queens somewhere. But the other thing I want to call upon, we were asked by the sponsoring agencies to pick a representative group of areas, not to make a comprehensive survey of everything that could be done, and also you've got to recognize there's some things you can do with committees, particularly volunteer committees, because no one on this committee was paid anything of who was a member, essentially, of the committee, although we did have a staff of, at one time, five technical people who were helping give us backup, because you can't do very much with volunteer committees unless you also have a good staff. At present, we only have Mr. Osinski and his secretary, who are continuing liaison in this general area. But I can't claim to be comprehensive. I can't claim we talked to everybody we ought to talk to. I am able to answer a good many questions, or we are able to, in terms of things that people think you didn't do, and then we're able to show that we did, because we were not entirely insensitive to the fact that there are people, and I don't think engineers are generally, frankly. Yeah, I think having had a group of people during the war who were both psychologists, and I had a small group of psychologists and a large group of engineers, and I had much less trouble in terms of people understanding people from my engineers than I did with my psychologists. I've just mentioned that a little bit off the side. Are there any other questions? I think we've gone about as long as it's profitable. And I want to ask the people who have been on the program, and remember to turn in your cards, and also if you're interested on the availability of committee reports, we have a list of them up at the front.
Sir, Nellis here. Sure enjoyed your report. I'm
well, this is a problem trying to carry on a discussion with a voluminous report like that and only giving a couple of samples.
Bill, I came in late. Which one is Professor Mark?
Down there, a young man.
I want to ask you a couple of questions.
We're taking all your words of advice you gave us in Washington. We're continuing to work the problem. The Donaldson, we are working quite closely with Tacoma now.
Joe Malone. Yes. Oh, hello, Dean. How are you?